52.
Okay, go ahead.
I came here in 50. Of course, at that time, the group was responsible for developing a ramjet. We're not even in the rocket business, per se. This was a carryover from the way it started out of Fort Bliss, where I went to work in March of 47 with the GE company, as a lab assistant working in the combustion and fuels development part out there. And then when they came down here, this continued on. And then in 51, I guess it was, or 50, shortly, not too long after they moved down here, the GE company lost their contract with the Army. And they spread people out all over the place, and some of them they fired, and some of them were transferred to civil service, picked up in civil service. And I went at that time then to the Malta test station of GE, where there was another part of the Hermes program going, which was a missile that be about the equivalent of the Corporal size missile. And that's where I started working on hydrogen peroxide decomposition and this kind of thing. And then I came back here in 53 and went to work for the government. At that time, the Redstone was beginning to pick up. So, but even at that time, there was there were no rocket engine test stands even here. And the first one was the interim stand that so-called, where the Redstones were fired, that was more or less bootlegged and built up out of the framework of that thing is old Navy high-pressure bottles that were cut and welded to make the beams and a lot of stuff like this. So, and the bunker where the instrumentation was were a couple of old tanks that were used to store phosphorus. In the old days, when the arsenal was a chemical plant, as well as a shell loading operation, they used phosphorus to fill some of the, or to make some of the stuff that they were putting in the shells, as well as for flares or this type of thing. And so those tanks were cut apart and re-welded together to form the blockhouse. And so it was a poor man's, yeah, honest to God, poor man's test stand.
Yeah.
And then the Redstone was fired on that.
Yeah. And,
but that was the first truly rocket engine test stand out in the area, out there.
You know, when you drive by today, you see those that bunker, which is three big
round things.
Yeah, big round pieces. Mm-hmm. It looks like tankage. What were they?
Those are the tanks. Those were the phosphorus storage tanks that were cut and then plate welded in there to form a room.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The things, if you look out at the stand, you'll see that the columns, a lot of them are round.
Mm-hmm.
Those were Navy gas bottles, mm-hmm, taken off of old nitrogen trailers or something like this that had the Navy had certified were no longer suitable for use, and the bottles taken off of those trailers and then used just as simply as structural steel.
Hmm.
So what else?
Yeah. Were you around about the time that ARPA started talking about, you know, large boosters?
Yeah.
Were you involved in that then?
Yes. Well, that, of course, came a lot of years later, but at that time, as you're well aware, the S-1 was sold as a demonstration of clustered engines. And the initial build-up of that thing was done by the group that that I later became in charge of when the fellow that was in charge left to go to industry. But the so I came into it at about the 9th or 10th firing, I forget which, out on the stand out there.
Of the S-1.
Of the S-1. Yeah. Of the S-1T.
Okay.
The test vehicle.
Right.
And the first shot out of the bag, we burned all 8 turbines. I remember that on the first test run that I had anything to do with direct responsibility for. And that was caused by simply having too cold an environment in the boat tail, too cold the locks, and the combination causing a locks-rich lead in the gas generator, which burned the damn turbines through. And but then I had charge of that all through the rest of the development, being the testing part of it, through the rest of the development and through the acceptance firing of flight stages before they went to Kennedy. And then later on the S-1C, same, we went through pretty much the same kind of procedure, although considerable less number of firings.
Were you involved in upper stages much at that time, or you mostly?
Well, indirectly, with having the responsibility for the government for sort of monitoring and bird dogging what the contractor was doing, either in Sacramento where the S-4 and the S-4B were fired, or down in Mississippi where the S-2 and later the S-1C were fired. So we had guys, and I myself spent a lot of time in both of those places doing, well, it was more monitoring, cajoling, kicking in the ass, whatever you want to call it. Just sorry, keeping the thing rolling and going on the government side. So, yeah, in that direction, yes, we were involved with the upper stages also. And then we, of course, had an S-4B stand out here. That was a geometrical similar to the flight stage. It was used for a J-2 engine primarily.
But most of your work done was done with the S-1 and the S-1C?
The development stages. Work, and this came because of the nature of what Marshall wanted to do. They developed basically the S-1. And they developed the S-1C, in spite of the fact that Boeing later took it over, and Chrysler took it over. Boeing claims to be its developer, but they aren't. The thing was designed at Marshall. Boeing also designed it, but parallel.
Well, that's interesting, because...
Comment on that?
You really can't say that the S-4 or S-4B had a parallel thing, as I understand it, you know. Marshall came up with, you know, basic specifications and a mission configuration. Douglas took it and then went ahead with the design configuration.
The S-1 and the S-1C followed pretty much the same route as the Jupiter, Redstone and Jupiter.
Yeah.
See, it's a carryover and a gradual dying of the Arsenal system. You familiar with what the Arsenal system was? Well, this was the S-1C was really the death throes of the Arsenal approach at Marshall. And that and because of that, and I'll explain now the other part of it, Boeing was given a prime contract and considered that they had that responsibility, but they really were never let in that respect, nor were they really prepared when they got that contract to do the job.
Well, wasn't in the early phases of the contract negotiation that Marshall Wood back put together the first three
stages? Boeing, though, in fact, has never accepted this concept as demonstrated or as measured by the number of people they brought on. They manned up day one as though they were going to do the whole bloody thing, and they didn't. Right?
Was that kind of wasteful of their manpower?
Damn right it was. When one day, I remember, and I don't know whether you want this on the record, but I don't care.
Okay.
Leave it. But it's a fact. You can go back in the newspaper and check it. One day, after Boeing was announced as a contractor, I got a call to come up to Heimberg's office that there was a Boeing management there. So I went up there, and here was Nelson from Boeing, and Cully and Dunnigan, and a guy who is now the one of our aldermen, Mr. Joe, what's his name? He's one of the ones that was elected last year. Writes newsletters to people. Joe, heck. Well, at any rate. And they proceeded. Stoner was with them, too. Yeah. And they proceeded then to talk about their manpower and how they would like to know how things were done and all these good things and how they were going to move in and do this job. Well, at that time, what we had in the S1C area was a hole in the ground. And we were in the process of blasting out foundation so that it could be made larger because of the change from the 2 to the 3 to the 5 engine business. And finally, we ran out of capacity after we had gone down the road with the construction of the stand and had to blast out and start over to a certain degree to increase the capacity for the 5 engine size. And they proceeded to say, we've got all these good guys and we're going to come in, you know, and we're going to do all these test operators. And so I didn't say anything in the meeting with Heimberg, but I said, fellas, do you like to have a little tour of the area? They said, oh, yeah, sure. So we got out the back door of the place, and I turned around and I said, now, looky here. Nobody has told me that you have a damn thing to do with the responsibility for testing that S1C out in this area. And until somebody does tell me with authority, I'm going to presume that you don't have any. Now, I don't know who the hell told you you did, but I'm telling you, you don't. So, that was, I believe, on a Thursday. Friday night's paper, Huntsville Times, had a big headline. 800 Boeing people arrive, responsible for test program, testing of the S1C and static firing and all this kind of stuff. And this is the manager, the local manager, Joe, whatever the hell his name is, came up from Eglin. And all this blah, blah, blah about all the good jobs they were going to create here in this thing. That weekend, the Boeing company in Seattle told 200 of their people that were in the test business in general terms to be down here Monday morning and ready. And all we had was a bloody hole in the ground out there.
What was the purpose of something like that? To bring Peter Marshall into giving him the test program?
Sure. Sure. So, on Monday morning, I cut this damn article out. In fact, I was packing my stuff. I just saw the damn thing at home. I took it into Heimberg's office, and I said, hey, Carl, what the hell is this? So he called up Slattery and chewed him. He says, well, release this thing. Slattery says, not me. And so it was a power play by the Boeing company. But it succeeded in giving them about 200 times 3 or 4, about 800 extra man years on their contract. And they sat in the damn Hick building down there with those 200 jackasses until we got this damn program going out here. But at that time, all was out there was a damn hole in the ground. We were still over firing S1s.
How did they get 800 man years out of it?
Well, they were in 4 years too soon and 200 people. Mm-hmm. those 200 people stayed here.
Did Marshall try to beat them back at all, or was it because things were relatively good they could afford to carry that extra weight?
That's right. It's just another one of those things. But they did, man. They upheavaled that whole 200 people and created all kinds of problems for them and their families and disposal of their houses and all this crap.
Now, did these people eventually go down to ETF when the death program got going down there?
We eventually had about 80 of them out here in a training role like we did with Chrysler.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of them then ended up down in MTF and at Michoud. Mm-hmm.
As you started up with your own test program out here, what kind of problems and difficulties did you run into?
Well, the first problem we had was with the steel that was being used for the load platform. It was tremendously thick plates, and it was a high-strength alloy steel. And the damn stuff started cracking. So we had a big ringtail doozy with the U.S. steel company over that thing, and they had consultants in, and we had consultants and all this kind of stuff. I guess in the S1C it went remarkably smooth. A lot of the stuff we had wrung out on the single F1 stands before we got to the full cluster. So it was, and they were pretty much a good representative geometric simulation of a segment of the cluster. So a lot of the procedures and these kind of things, measuring programs and that type of thing, were pretty well worked out before we came to the cluster. So as a comparison, we had something like, by my mind remembers, about 36 firings on the S1. We had 17 on the S1C. The S1 got to be, there's no other program, so you just keep on going. That'll lengthen your your testing program. When something doesn't come in to replace something, you don't shut it off, you just keep on going with it.
Did you learn anything by making those refinements and procedures that were later developed for the F1?
For the F1, yeah, sure.
Measuring and things like that?
Oh, yeah. But one thing that did come out, the F1 is an awful lot rougher on instrumentation than the S1 was. So we had some difficulties in getting reliable transducers and this type of thing. I guess the main thing was the learning process was just the biggerness factor of the whole thing. But basically we didn't really have that many difficulties.
Did any of the Boeing people come in for training on the S1 so they could extrapolate information to the
That was another funny phenomena with the Boeing company. About a year. And I guess this you ought to take off the record.
Okay.
In this parallel design, was a lot of design work done back in Seattle, or did they actually wait till they got set up in Michoud? By this time, the design was pretty well far along.
The design was done here.
Yeah, but they did some parallel designs, like actuator arms and stuff like that.
Actuators were GFE to Boeing. Astrionics Lab went out and contracted directly for the development of those actuators. In fact, there are pieces of the whole Saturn stack that its evolution changed. I mean, it evolved into a different thing as of today, but there were pieces of that whole thing that either the design or the hardware itself, or the design and the hardware, were furnished to the contractors to put into that to that bird.
Mm-hmm.
The design of the IU, for instance, and the electrical boxes that went down through the stack from the IU on down were a GFE design to North American and to Douglas and to IU, I mean to IBM. And the actuators were different. In some cases they were GFE'd, like the S1C. In the case of the S2 and the S4B, they were furnished by the contractor themselves. But Marshall was all woven in and out of that thing. As I say, it was a...
But where was...
It's the death throes of a group of people that were brought up in the arson approach. You don't just erode that kind of thing rapidly.
Now, if Boeing did do some design, where did they do this? Did they do this back in...
They did it down the Hick Building.
Or in the Hick Building.
Yeah. No, Seattle had very little. They had Wichita, did, you know, the...
Wirings.
Yeah, some of the structural parts and things like that.
Tulik.
Yeah.
Is Wichita doing mainly the Tulik?
No, Wichita furnished some parts. I think they made the bores and some of these for the bulkheads. Even though they were welded together at Michoud. Pieces of the wiring were done at Michoud. The billets were made in a shipyard down on the Mississippi coast sometime. And then the welding together of them and the machining of the wiring itself was done in Michoud.
Didn't they do a couple of wirings here?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a lot of these procedures and things were worked out over here in ME. Now, what the hell is it called now? PE or
P and B-E.
No, the shops. Manufacturing engineering is what it used to be called. Now it's called product and manufacturing technology or some goddamn thing. I don't know. It's a shops area.
Yeah.
Fabrication area. It used to be called Fab Lab back then, and I still call it Fab Lab. See, a lot of those procedures were worked out over here. How to weld the bulkheads. How to attach the, and the first, as you pointed out, the first three birds were made here. This was the T-bird, the D-bird, and the first flight bird.
Mm-hmm.
Then the first and second flight bird, I guess. I'd have to go back and refresh my memory. The first bird made at Michoud was the facilities bird, and then flight bird. So when three came across the stand up here, Boeing, through the process of fighting with each other, Boeing was responsible for the static firing by contract, the static firing of that bird. And so they came in with their flag on the stand and all this, and I told him, get that goddamn flag off of that stand, you son of a bitch. And I made him take it down. So I had a running gun battle with the Boeing Company the whole time.
Did you do some work on the Pogo?
Yeah.
Problems?
Yeah, the...
Maybe on S1C?
On the S1C and also on the over in the components area, they did it on the S2.
Mm-hmm.
We also had the S2 structural test area, which was a structural test stand, which is down by the S1C stand there, which was not set up for that purpose, but later was used to find the contributing pieces of the structural compliance and these kind of things that went into the whole model, the structural model, the dynamics model of the Saturn. Those were, that data was gleaned out of that test stand there. Yeah.
Could you go in more to the Pogo problems that you had and the studies and fixes that finally came out of it?
Oh, okay. Well, I can remember back, one of the first things that a Brown kept hitting people over the head with was Provo on the Saturn V. People have witnessed Pogo before. One of the classic ones, I guess, was the Bomark, which was a pressure-fed system that literally tore itself to pieces. And are you familiar with what Pogo basically is?
Yeah, I think
so. In other
so.
Words, a coupling, a divergent coupling between the variation in thrust and the response of the dam structural system, so the thing starts to feed on itself, and finally something gives, and it goes. So everybody said, well, hell, Pogo, we've looked at it and all this, and we ain't got no Pogo in Saturn V.
Marshall was saying this too?
Oh, yeah.
Was that because of the large some of the structure, and I thought there was no damping in it to...
It was because of the analytical assumptions they had made, which turned out to just not be right. Now, there are two kinds, or there can be Pogo within a Pogo, if I get myself straight. The S1C was more like a true Pogo. In other words, the total vehicle really got involved with the thing. The S2 was I've heard referred to as a mini Pogo or something like this, but it was within the bird, within that stage itself, the structural compliance of the thrust frame, of the thrust structure with the engines and the natural frequency of the whole thing. And that thing was a miss, well, two things wrong. Rocketdyne had, by an order of magnitude, underestimated the compliance of their engine. In both cases.
The F1 and the J2.
They didn't know. In spite of running 850 million tests, they didn't know the true compliance of those engines. And the data that was later gathered by us on the stands out there showed, by pulsing the engine inlet, in other words, you feed a pulse in and see what, is it attenuated, is it increased, and how does it feed through the engine. Showed that they were off by an order of magnitude. No two ways about it. And so that was one thing that was wrong in the assumptions that were made in the analytical thing. But all this happened after the fact, and not before the fact.
All this came up then after the first Saturn V flight.
That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then there was a phenomena, and this is my own analysis, which was later proven but never really admitted. There's a phenomena with any centrifugal type pump that at a certain set of conditions, that thing and a certain design of inducer, as all of the Rocketdyne engines have, and you can make it happen on any of them, but the Rocketdyne engines, they claim don't have it, but it does happen, because it's a natural phenomenon. We had it back on the Jupiter, and it is a point when... are you familiar at all with the... Are you guys engineers?
Nope.
No?
We're historians.
Oh, okay! Well, maybe I'm not doing any good.
No, you are, because this is what we're trying to get into, exactly what you're talking about.
We're trying to be historians of technology.
Yeah.
There's a thing called an NPSH, net positive suction head.
Okay.
Head curve, okay? And as you come along here with a pump, which means that you're dropping pump inlet conditions, with a cryogenic, it's either the, or with any liquid, it's the, either the temperature is going up so that you're coming closer to the vapor pressure, or you're dropping the pressure, which says that you're coming closer to the vapor pressure. In any centrifugal pump, there's a point where you get a negative slope like this before the dam performance goes down to zero. What happens in this thing, if you dwell in here, is that if you are looking at your pump inlet pressure, now if I have pump here and I'm coming in like so and out like so, say, if I look at this pressure, pump inlet pressure here, I will see in this region right here the nicest damn oscillator you ever saw. And the trouble is that this point will be a function of a specific number, like a one empirical relationship that's used is called a THOLMA factor. I don't remember all of what's in it now, but any pump of a given class and geometry, you can correlate the point at which this phenomena occurs to within a very small variance. But for any given build, in terms of what you normally look at, the pump, the NPSH, it'll look like these things aren't really like that. So every pump will have this happen at a different set of operating conditions, but a common value of this thing. Mm-hmm. Now,